dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Earlier this month, a major conference on the fight to prevent the corporate takeover of the world's water resources took place in Rhinebeck, New York, in the Hudson Valley. We're pleased to be able to bring you the first of a series of presentations from that conference, Water of Life, Perils and Promise in the 21st Century. On this week's show, we'll hear first from Robert Kennedy Jr., who is an attorney with the Hudson River Keepers, and then Tony Clark from the Polaris Institute in Toronto.
This is my privilege to welcome and introduce Robert Kennedy Jr. to open this Water of Life conference. In this Hudson Valley and in this region, Robert Kennedy does not need any introduction. But what inspires me and many others that in the past, the Kennedy family had followed the politics of the White House, but Robert Kennedy Jr. is following the path of politics of the earth. And when we can see that the interest of the United States, interest of all nations of the world, interest of whole humanity is embedded in the interest of the earth itself. And Robert Kennedy, here in this Hudson Valley, by becoming part of River Keepers and symbolizing the Hudson River as that aspect which protects and which serves and which takes care of our earth so that humanity and life other than humanity, all life, considering it sacred life, survives, thrives, blossoms, and sustains itself. And therefore, I am deeply grateful to Robert Kennedy for accepting this invitation to come and open this conference.
Thanks. I have a little bit of laryngitis, so but I think my vocal cords will warm up as I go along. And I'm really happy to be back here at Omega, which is one of the jewels of the Hudson Valley. And it was a treat for me to have dinner tonight with these incredible array of people, Maude and Anita, some of the heroes of the environment, and Vandana and Satish. All of them who are brilliant people, and we had a wonderful conversation. And at one point, and I want to kind of make that the theme of what I talk about tonight, Vandana told a story during dinner about what's happening in India now, where there's these giant diversion projects, where the rivers that come out of the Himalayas are now being diverted towards not even agriculture, but towards the industrial users in other cities, and away from the traditional valleys where they fertilize the land of poor peasants. And they're being diverted to new industrial uses that are the product of globalization. And we're creating a world that's so topsy-turvy that the water no longer flows downhill. It flows towards the money. And Satish said to me at one point, he said, you know, do you think that President Bush is just an aberration? That that this is just a horrible mistake that was made, and that, you know, we'll learn a lesson from it and move on. And I said, no, I think that this is the face of globalization. This is the face, you know, this is the final battle. This is Armageddon. This is the battle against ignorance and greed. And, you know, that the forces of ignorance and greed are going to greet us with the seduction of a warm handshake and a congenial smile, and then they're going to divert the rivers towards the big money people. And I'm sorry. I'm like, and what we're seeing now, you know, not only in India, is this extraordinary effort and successful effort to privatize the commons, to privatize those aspects of our planet that are vital to life. And a few months ago, there was an article in the New York Times that said that it described a survey that had just been completed that said one out of every four black children in New York City has asthma. And we don't know why there's this explosion of asthma and food allergies among people in the United States and other Western nations. Three of my children have asthma, three of my sons. But we do know that the asthma attacks are prompted or triggered by two things, by particulates in the air and by ozone. And we know that the largest sources of those materials now in the air in New York is coming from coal-burning power plants in the Ohio Valley. And those power plants under the Clean Water Act were supposed to have shut down years ago, and President Bush just gave them, essentially just waived that part of the Clean Air Act so that they'll be able to pollute forever, to continue to do what they're doing forever. Recently, up in the Catskills, there was testing done on some of the fish in the Neversink Reservoir by the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. The Neversink is the most remote and highly protected of all the New York City's reservoirs. There's never been industry there. And we found that the fish have so much mercury in them that they're too contaminated to safely eat. The state of Connecticut recently banned consumption of any freshwater fish in the state, except for one exception, hatchery-bred trout. And 17 other states have recently banned every single freshwater fish in their states. So we have, and there's no geological source of mercury in the state of Connecticut. That mercury is coming from industrial sources, but 50% of it, between 50 and 80% of the mercury emissions in this country are coming from those same Ohio Valley power plants, which kill 30,000 people a year. They're owned by six companies. They kill 30,000 people a year in this country. We have now the Adirondacks, half of the lakes are sterilized because of acid rain, and the primary source of the acid rain is those same power plants. And we are losing the forest carpet from the Adirondacks all the way up the Appalachian chain into Canada. And again, the source of that acid rain is those primarily the same Ohio Valley power plants. So these people who gave $48 million to the Bush campaign and now have permission to pollute essentially forever are literally stealing the air from children in New York City. And they have deprived the children in the state of Connecticut of the primal, seminal American experience of going fishing with their fathers or their mothers and bringing home the fish and eating them. They can't do that anymore. This is like a science fiction nightmare where the rich people the wealthy and influential people, if they want to use their wealth that way, can literally steal the air and the water from the people of our country. This is not just happening in India. A woman said to me, last night, I was in Columbus, Ohio, and a student there sat across from me at Denison University, and she said, you know, don't we have to choose between, you know, the comfort of the birds and the fishes and the animals versus the prosperity of our country? And, you know, my answer to her was that we're not protecting nature for the sake of the fishes and the birds. We're protecting it because it's the infrastructure of our communities. And if we want to meet our obligation as a generation, as a nation, as a civilization, which is to create communities for our children that give them the same opportunities for dignity and enrichment as the community and good health as the communities that our parents gave us, we've got to start by protecting our environmental infrastructure. The groups that I work for, two environmental groups. One is a large national group called Natural Resources Defense Council. And the other one that I've worked for 20 years and came into the environmental movement working for is called Riverkeeper, or the Waterkeeper Alliance is the national group, but the Riverkeeper is where I started. And the Riverkeeper was started by a group of people who probably never used the term environmentalist to describe themselves. They were people who were fighting for their community, for their property values, for their recreational values, for their livelihoods. The Riverkeeper was started in the Hudson Valley back in 1966 by a blue-collar coalition of commercial and recreational fishermen who mobilized to reclaim the river from its polluters. We have on the Hudson River one of the oldest commercial fisheries in North America. It's 350 years old. Many of the people that I represent come from families that have been fishing the river continuously since Dutch colonial times. It's a traditional gear fishery, meaning that the fishermen use the same fishing methods, the small open boats, the ash poles, and the gill nets that were taught by the Algonquin Indians to the original Dutch settlers of New Amsterdam and then passed down through the generations. One of the enclaves of the commercial fishery on the Hudson is a little village called Crotonville, New York. There's a lot of fishing villages, particularly Verplank is one of the largest ones, but Crotonville's 30 miles north of the city on the east bank of the river. And the people who lived in Crotonville in 1966 were not your, you know, prototypical tweed-jacketed, pipe-smoking, bearded, affluent environmentalists who's trying to protect distant wilderness areas in the Rockies or Montana or what have you. They were factory workers, carpenters, lathers, electricians. Half the people in Crotonville made their living, or at least some part of it, either crabbing or fishing the Hudson. For them, for the most part, they had little expectation that they'd ever... You want me to just hold it? Okay. Anyway, for the most part, these were people who didn't really ever expect to see Yosemite or the Yellowstone or the Everglades, the national parks. For them, their environment was their backyard. It was the bathing beaches and the swimming holes and the fishing holes of the Hudson River. Richie Garrett, who was the first president of the Riverkeeper, used to say about the Hudson, it's our Riviera, it's our Monte Carlo. Richie Garrett was a grave digger from Austining, New York. He used to tell his new followers, I'll be the last to let you down. But in 1966... Penn Central Railroad began vomiting oil from a 4.5-foot pipe in the Croton Harmon rail yard. And the oil went up the river on the tides, and it blackened the beaches, and it made the shad taste of diesel so that they couldn't be sold at the Fulton Fish Market down in the city. And all of the people in Crotonville came together in the only public building in the town, which was a room almost exactly this size. And it was the Parker Bale American Legion Hall. And there were 300 people there that night. And this was a very patriotic community. Almost all the original founders, board members and officers of Riverkeeper were former Marines. Richie Garrett was a former Marine. They were combat veterans from Vietnam and from Korea and from World War II. These were not radicals. In fact, Crotonville, New York had the highest mortality rate during World War II of any community in this country during the first 2 years of the war. Virtually the entire male population joined the Marines the day after Pearl Harbor. These weren't radicals, they weren't militants, these were people whose patriotism was rooted in the bedrock of our country. But that night they started talking about violence because they saw something that they thought they owned, which was that, you know, the abundance of these fisheries that their parents had exploited for generations and the purity of the Hudson's waters, and it was being robbed from them by large corporate entities over whom they had no control. And they'd been to the government agencies that are supposed to protect Americans from pollution, to the Corps of Engineers and the Conservation Department and the Coast Guard, and they were given the bum's rush. At one point, the Corps colonel in Manhattan, after 20 separate visits by Richie Garrett and another Marine named Art Glauca, the Corps colonel in Manhattan finally told them, begging him to do his job, his duty, which was to shut down that Penn Central pipe, he finally told them in exasperation, these are important people. Speaking of the Penn Central Board of Directors, we can't treat them that way. In other words, we can't force them to obey the law. And by this evening, in March of 1966, virtually everybody in Crotonville had come to the conclusion that government was in cahoots with the polluters, and that the only way that they were going to reclaim the river for themselves is if they confronted the polluters directly. And somebody suggested that they put a match to the oil slick coming out of the Penn Central pipe and burn up the pipe. Somebody else said they should roll a mattress up and jam it up the pipe and flood the rail yard with its own waste. Somebody else said that they should float a raft of dynamite into the intake of the Indian Point power plant, which at that time was killing 1 million fish a day on its intake screens and taking food off their family tables. And then a guy stood up who was named another Marine, a Korean War vet named Bob Boyle, and he was the outdoor editor of Sports Illustrated magazine, and he still is today. He's been there for 55 years. He was a great fly fisherman and angler. He was one of the gurus of dry fly fishing in this country. He'd written half a dozen books on angling. And 2 years before, he had written an article about angling in the Hudson for Sports Illustrated. And in researching that article, he had come across an ancient navigational statute called the 1888 Rivers and Harbors Act. And that statute said that it was illegal to pollute any waterway in the United States, that you had to pay a high penalty if you got caught, but also there was a bounty provision that said that anybody who turned in the polluter got to keep half the fine. And he sent a copy of the law over to the libel lawyers at Time, Inc., and he said to them, is this still good law? And they sent him a memo back saying, in 80 years, it has never been enforced, but it's still on the books, and it's good law. And that evening, when all those men were talking about violence, he stood up in front of them with a copy of the law, and he said, you know, we shouldn't be talking about breaking the law. We should be talking about enforcing it. And they resolved that evening that they were going to start a group that was then called the Hudson River Fishermen's Association. It later became Riverkeeper. And they were going to go out and track down and prosecute every polluter on the Hudson. 18 months later, they collected the first bounty in United States history under this 19th century statute. They shut down the Penn Central pipe for good. They got to keep $2,000, which was a huge amount of money, in Crotonville, New York in 1968. There were 2 weeks of wild celebration in the town. And they used the money that was left over to go after Seba Geigy and Tuck Tape and Standard Brand and American Cyanamid and the biggest corporations in America. And the government agencies that then and today are the biggest polluters in our countries all over the world. They sued the New York National Guard successfully for filling a wetland in Peekskill, Westchester County for dumping illegally from Croton Point. In 1973, they collected the highest penalty in United States history against a corporate polluter. They got $200,000. From Anaconda Wire and Cable for dumping toxics at Hastings, New York. They used that money to construct a boat, which they called the Riverkeeper. They used bounty money in 1983 to hire their first full-time Riverkeeper, a former commercial fisherman named John Cronin. He hired me a year later as the prosecuting attorney for the group. And about a year after that, we started at Pace Law School in White Plains, New York, which is a law school that specializes in environmental law. A litigation clinic, which I operate today with my partner, Carl Copeland, in conjunction with my work for Riverkeeper. And we have 10 third-year law students who, by a special court order, are permitted to practice law under our supervision as if they were attorneys. They can do anything a lawyer can do. We give them each 4 polluters to sue at the beginning of the semester. They file complaints, and they do discovery. They do depositions. They go to court and argue their cases. 3 months ago, 3 of my students won a case just across the river from here, the highest penalty against a corporate polluter or a municipal polluter under the Clean Water Act in American history. They got $5.6 million penalty against New York City for destroying at about probably $100 million worth of rehabilitation for destroying a trout stream, which they're going to be forced to rehabilitate, the Esopus Creek up in the Catskill. And of course, if they don't win the case, they don't pass the course. And since we started the clinic, we brought over 300 successful legal actions against Hudson River polluters. We forced polluters on the river. We forced polluters on the river to spend over $3 billion on remediation of the Hudson. And today, the Hudson River is an international model for ecosystem protection. This is a waterway that was a national joke in 1966. It was dead water for 20-mile stretches north of New York City, south of Albany. It caught fire. It changed colors sometimes 2 or 3 times a week, depending on what color they were painting the trucks at the GM plant in Tarrytown. Today, it's the richest water body in the North Atlantic. It's an international model for ecosystem protection. The Hudson produces more pounds of fish per acre than any other waterway in the Atlantic Ocean north of the equator, more biomass per gallon, and it's the last major river system left in the North Atlantic, on both sides of the North Atlantic. And I'll throw in the Mediterranean, the Black Sea, the Baltic, the Aegean, the Adriatic, the Marmara, the Dardanelles, the Bosphorus, all of the rivers that flow into those. The Hudson is the only one left that still has strong spawning stocks of all of its historical species of migratory fish. It's Noah's Ark. It's a species warehouse. It's the last refuge for many of these animals that are going extinct elsewhere. And the miraculous resurrection of the Hudson has inspired the creation now of riverkeepers on waterways across North America. We just licensed our 114th riverkeeper. We own the keeper name. Each riverkeeper has to have a patrol boat. They have to have a full-time paid riverkeeper, and they have to be willing to sue polluters. We have explosive growth now in Canada. We have keepers on every major waterway on the West Coast, from Cook Inlet in Alaska. We have four on Puget Sound. We have them on the Columbia, the Tualatin, the Willamette, San Francisco Bay. We have five river keepers. We have them on San Diego Bay, Santa Monica Bay, the Orange County coast. We have a picket line all the way down to Laguna San Ignacio on the Baja Peninsula in Mexico, operated by Mexican fishermen down there, and on the East Coast, on all the major rivers from the Bay of Fundy in Canada to the St. John's in Florida. We have explosive growth in the Gulf, throughout Latin America. We have many more applications than we can handle for riverkeepers. We've licensed our, this summer I'm going to Australia to license our first six, or we have one over there already, but six new riverkeepers in Australia, but we have many in Europe. Actually, the field director, Sean Larkin, if I can ask you to stand up, who's in charge of licensing the new keepers. But we're probably now one of the fastest growing environmental groups in the United States. I love my job. I love working with the fishermen, being out on the water, going to court, fighting against the bad guys, working with the students. A couple of years ago, my clients asked me to do something that I never wanted to do, which was to spend a lot of my time in Washington, D.C. This is when the Gingrich Congress came in 1995. And I have to say this, my clients are fishermen. They run the range of the political spectrum from right-wing Republican to left-wing Democrat, everything in between. Sometimes I go out on the boats with them, or I go to the bait shacks at the end of the day and just, you know, listen to them talk. And it's scary, some of the stuff they say. But without exception, they saw what was happening on Capitol Hill beginning in 1995 and culminating with this White House, which is the most antagonistic towards environmental protection of any White House we've had in our history. And they see this as the gravest threat, not just to their livelihoods, but to their values, their sense of citizenship, their sense of community, their understanding of what it means to be American. And we, you know, and they're right. If the laws that are currently proposed by this White House, and there's over 100 anti-environmental rollbacks that you can look at on the NRDC website if you're interested, if even a fraction of those are passed, we will have, by this time next year, no significant federal environmental law left in our country. That is not exaggeration. That is not hyperbole. It is a fact. We will be, you know, many of our laws will remain on the books in one form or the other, but we'll be like Mexico, which has these wonderful poetic environmental laws, but they can't be enforced. And nobody knows about them and nobody complies with them because they can't be enforced. And if you ask the people on Capitol Hill and now in the White House, why are you doing this, who are promoting these kind of initiatives, why are you doing this? And this is what I've been doing for, you know, with a lot of my time over the past several years. What they invariably say is the same thing that that girl said to me and the student said to me in Ohio last night, which was, well, the time has come in our nation's history where we have to choose now between economic prosperity on the one hand and environmental protection on the other. And that is a false choice. In 100% of the situations, good environmental policy is identical to good economic policy. If we want to measure our economy, and this is how we ought to be measuring it, based upon how it produces jobs and the dignity of jobs over the generations, and how it preserves the values of community assets over the generations, over the long term, if, on the other hand, we want to do what they've been urging us to do from the White House, which is to treat the planet as if it were a business in liquidation, to convert our natural resources to cash as quickly as possible, to have a few years of pollution-based prosperity, we can generate an instantaneous cash flow and the illusion of a prosperous economy, but our children are going to pay for our joyride, and they're going to pay for it with denuded landscapes and poor health and huge cleanup costs that are going to amplify over time, and they're never going to be able to pay. Environmental injury is deficit spending. It's a way of loading the cost of this generation's prosperity onto the backs of our children. And if you don't believe that, if you have doubts about that, look at the nations that didn't invest in their environment back in the 70s the way that we did in this country. All of our environmental investment began on Earth Day 1970. And I remember what it was like before Earth Day. I remember the Cuyahoga River burning for a week and nobody being able to put it out with flames that were eight stories high. I remember when they declared Lake Erie dead. I remember that I couldn't swim in the Hudson or the Charles or the Potomac growing up, and what the air smelt like in Washington, D.C., where I lived as a youth, which wasn't even an industrial city. We had to dust in our home every day for the soot. Some days you couldn't see down the block for the smog. We had thousands of Americans dying in our cities every year during smog events. These young congressmen and, you know, policymakers in the White House, they don't remember that these days. They don't see the benefits that this nation has reaped by investing in its environmental infrastructure. All they see is the costs, you know, of compliance to their campaign contributors. And, you know, I'm a falconer. I'll tell you one other story. I'm a licensed master falconer, which means I train hawks and hunt with them. And I've been doing this since I was 11 years old. And I just stepped down as president of the New York State Falconers Association. I run a rehabilitation center at my home for injured and orphaned raptors, hawks, and owls. I breed hawks. I band them for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And I've been interested in hawks, and my mother says obsessed, since I was 3 or 4 years old. But when I was 9 or 10, I would go, we lived in Northern Virginia, and I would go up to Washington, D.C. once every couple of weeks with 9 or 10 of my brothers and sisters to eat lunch with my father at the Justice Department, or occasionally to visit my uncle at the White House. And whenever I'd go to the White House, I'd always look down Pennsylvania Avenue to the old post office building in Washington, D.C., where there was a pair of Eastern and Adams peregrine falcons nesting on the roof. And they'd been there probably since Lincoln's time. And they were, you know, they'd always been in a pair on the post office almost since it was built. And we, and all the falconers knew about them, and bird watchers. And this was the most spectacular predatory bird we had in North America. It was the most beautiful of all the subspecies of peregrines. It was salmon pink. It had a beautiful white coverlet on its sear. It could fly 240 miles an hour, the fastest bird on Earth. And I could watch these birds come off the roof of the post office, come down Pennsylvania Avenue at those speeds, and pick pigeons out of the air 40 feet above the heads of the pedestrians, you know, right in front of the White House, and then fly them back to the cupola of the post office. And to me, seeing a sight like that was far more exciting than visiting my uncle at the White House. But that's a sight that my children will never see, because that bird went extinct in 1963, the same year that my uncle was killed, because of DDT poisoning. And we have falcons now, you know, back, peregrines back in New York City and on the bridges here across the Hudson and up and down the East Coast. But it's a different bird. It's a hybridized progeny of 17 different subspecies that were mixed and matched and bred in captivity and released into the wild. And it's nowhere near as spectacular, in my view, as this creature that took 1 million years to evolve and then disappeared in the blink of an eye because of ignorance and greed. And I never saw herons growing up. I never saw egrets, ospreys, bald eagles, which we see every day. You know, you'll see them as you visit here, all of those birds. But they were gone because of DDT, and many of our songbirds were disappearing. And in 1970, this accumulation of insults drove 20 million Americans out onto the street, 10% of our population, the largest public demonstration in American history, demanding that our political leaders return to the American people the ancient environmental rights that had been stolen from our citizens over the previous 80 years. And the political system responded. Republicans and Democrats got together, and over the next 10 years, we passed 28 major environmental laws. Nixon created EPA, signed the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act into effect. And those laws protect our air, water, endangered species, food safety, wetlands, etc. And they've become the model now for over 130 nations around the world that had their own versions of Earth Day and began making their own investments in their environmental infrastructure. But there's a lot of countries that didn't do it. And invariably, those were the countries that didn't have strong democracies, because democracy and the environment are intertwined. You cannot get sustained environmental protection under any system of government except for a locally based democracy. And there's 1 million reasons for that I'm not going to go into, but the major one is that the animals and the fishes and the birds and the future generations don't participate in the political process. And those, their interests only get represented in a locally based democracy where individuals can stand up who share those values and empathize with those values, can stand up and inject those values into the political process. And that doesn't happen in a tyranny. And that is why there's a direct correlation around the world between the level of tyranny in various governments and the level of environmental degradation in those countries, whether it's right-wing tyrannies like Brazil during the 70s or Saddam Hussein's Iraq during the 80s and 90s, or left-wing tyrannies like, you know, Eastern Europe or China or the Soviet Union, where they're now facing these, you know, science fiction catastrophes because of their failure to invest in their environmental infrastructure. Russia's a great example. In Russia, they didn't have a democracy in the Soviet Union, so they didn't have an Earth Day, so they had no environmental law. They didn't, for example, have NEPA, which was the first, you know, and most important statute that we have, or we had until the Bush administration came in and is now in the process of destroying it. But it's the law, our most important environmental law, and it's the law that requires government agencies to do an environmental review or impact statement before they dismantle or destroy or dispose of an important public trust resource, part of the commons. And they didn't have that in Russia, and because of that, the Aral Sea, which is the largest freshwater body on Earth after the Great Lakes, is now a desert. They didn't have a Clean Water Act in Russia, and because of that, the Sea of Azov, the richest fish nursery on Earth after the Chesapeake Bay, is now a biological wasteland. They didn't have nuclear regulatory review requirements of the kind we passed in this country after Earth Day, and because of that, one-fifth of Belarusia is now permanently uninhabitable from radiation contamination. In Turkey, where I was this autumn, they don't have a Clean Water Act. 300 species have disappeared from the Marmara Sea over the past 15 years. The Black Sea will be dead within 10. In Thailand, where I also was in the autumn, they don't have a Clean Air Act. You can see people on any street in Bangkok wearing gas masks and particle masks. The New York Times recently reported that the average child in Bangkok, and this is a city larger than New York, 11 million people, the average child who reaches the age of 6 has permanently lost 7 IQ points because the density of airborne lead contamination at ground level, because they didn't have a Clean Air Act that said you got to get the lead out of the gasoline. In China, they lose 150,000 people dead in Beijing every year from smog events. One of the growth industries in Beijing today is oxygen bars, where people literally go to buy a breath of fresh air. In Mexico City, if you own an automobile, you can legally only drive it 3.5 days a week. Smog inversions kill 10,000 people a year and shut down their principal state industry, sometimes for weeks at a time. In those nations, and many, many, many others, environmental injury has matured into economic catastrophe. And that's what would have happened here if we hadn't made that investment on Earth Day, after Earth Day, back in the 1970s. And that's what will happen if we allow this reckless Congress and foolhardy White House to dismantle 30 years of environmental law. And one of the things that I've done, been doing over the past several years, is to constantly go around and confront this argument that an investment in our environment is a diminishment of our nation's wealth. It doesn't diminish our wealth. It's an investment in infrastructure. The same as investing in telecommunications and road construction. It's an investment we have to make if we're going to ensure the economic vitality of our generation and of the next. One of the other things that they love to say on Capitol Hill is that... And in Canada, and this is happening all over, is we'll get rid of the federal laws, you know, and the federal EPA and all the federal, the bad, big bad federal bureaucracy, and we'll return control to the states. And the states are after, that's local democracy, and that's, you know, local control, states' rights, just like it was during the civil rights movement. You remember how good the states were about that, about civil rights. And you know, that's the essence of democracy, And after all, the states are in the best position to patrol and police and protect their own environment. But the real outcome of that devolution will not be local control. It will be corporate control. Because these large corporations can so easily dominate the state political landscapes. And we remember in the Hudson Valley, the 1960s version of community control. Before we had the federal environmental laws, and this tale can be told 10,000 times across this country on any community that has a river in it, practically. But the big culprit on the Hudson was General Electric. And GE came into these poverty-stricken towns in upstate New York, Fort Edward and Hudson's Falls, where the economies had collapsed after the, you know, destruction of the lumber industry in the Adirondacks. And they said to the town fathers, we're going to build you a spanking new factory. We're going to bring in 1,500 new jobs. We're going to raise your tax base. And all you have to do is waive your environmental laws and let us dump our toxic PCBs into the Hudson River and persuade the state of New York to write us a permit to do it. And if you don't do it, we're going to move to New Jersey and we'll do it from across the river. And you'll still get the PCBs, but they'll get the jobs and they'll get the taxes. And Fort Edward and Hudson's Falls took the bait. And 2 decades later, General Electric closed those factories, fired the workers, and they left the Hudson Valley with their pockets stuffed with cash, the richest corporation in the history of mankind. And they left behind a $2 billion cleanup bill that nobody in the Hudson Valley can afford. And I have 1,000 commercial fishermen, my clients, who are now permanently out of work because although the Hudson is loaded with fish, the fishes are still loaded with General Electric's PCBs, and they're too toxic to legally sell in the marketplace. And the barge traffic on the upper river has dried up because the shipping channels are too toxic to dredge. And all of that beautiful shoreline property, the best property in those towns that was given to General Electric with tax breaks from the grateful localities, is now permanently off the tax rolls, robbed from those communities as a source of revenue and recreation. And every woman between Oswego, New York, and Albany has elevated levels of PCB in her breast milk. And everybody in the Hudson Valley has General Electric's PCBs in our flesh and in our organs. And what the federal laws were meant to do was to put an end to that kind of corporate blackmail and to stop these corporations from coming in and whipsawing one community in New York against another in New Jersey, to get them to race to bottom, to lower their environmental standards, to recruit these filthy industries in exchange for the promise of a few years of pollution-based prosperity and to ransom their children's futures in the process. And what the federal laws did for our country is they democratized our country in an extraordinary way. You know, and I would argue that more than any of the other progressive social movements in our nation's history, that, you know, the environmental movement has been successful in democratizing America. And all of the, you know, whether it's labor movement or the civil rights movement or the women's movement, they're all meant to democratize our country, to push out power, to allow power to be shared by the most alienated and vulnerable members of our society. And more people have a share in that dialogue. But I would say that none of them has done that. All of them have done it very effectively. But we have established institutions in this country that we take for granted. You know, the permit hearings and environmental impact statements, which are just cost-benefit analysis that force an industry or somebody's going to propose a project in your backyard. Anybody in this room, if somebody comes into your community and says, we're going to put a corporate hog factory in your backyard, you have the right to say, well, you know, and we'll bring you a lot of jobs and prosperity to your community. You have the right to say to them, wait a second, I want to see a cost-benefit analysis over the next generations of what this really going to do to our community, and force them to look before you leap. And you have a right to that. You have a right to a permit hearing on that EIS, and you have a right to bring in your witnesses and cross-examine their witnesses. And you have a right to a judicial decision based on that EIS and the hearing that is based upon a rational interpretation of the evidence. And if you don't get it, you can appeal. And if there are polluters in your backyard and the government doesn't enforce the law against them, anybody in this room, anywhere in America, can step into the shoes of the United States attorney, drag that polluter in front of a federal judge, and prosecute him for penalties of $30,000 a day and injunctive relief. And, you know, these laws allow us, these right-to-know laws and toxic inventory laws that make government and industry transparent on the local level, they democratize us, and they allow even the most vulnerable people in our countries to participate in the dialogue that determines the destinies of our communities. And it's an extraordinary thing we have in this country. If you go to Canada, you know, which is a democracy and one of my favorite countries in the world, but if somebody wants to put a hog factory up in Maud's backyard in Canada, she kind of has two things she can do, which is, one, she can write a letter to the editor, and, you know, two, she can vote against the government the next time it comes up for election. But here we really have this capacity to, you know, participate in the local level. And industry comes in and says, well, you know, that's terrible for us because, you know, it's going to take us 2 years to build this project instead of one, and, you know, it's going to cost us more money to do all these environmental controls. And they're right. Democracy in the short term is sloppy, it's messy, it's expensive, and it's difficult. But in the long run, there's no system that's more efficient. And, you know, the best testimony to that is what's happened to the nuclear industry in this country, because, you know, that was done in the old style before we had environmental laws in the 60s when they got together in little rooms, the big business guys and the, you know, and the government, and they said, we're going to do this. And if anybody asked them at that point, well, what are you going to do with the stuff, you know, when the plant's decommissioned in 30 years for the next 30,000 years? You know, five times the length of recorded human history. And they didn't have to answer that question, right? Because we didn't have environmental impact statements back then. So they got to do this, and now we've got $1 trillion of cost overruns on these plants alone, and the big bills haven't even come in yet. And it's the most catastrophically expensive form of energy ever devised. And you know, we wouldn't have walked down that cul-de-sac, and we could have been investing in renewables and wind if we put even a fraction of what we put into nuclear, into wind and solar and all these other, you know, alternatives. You know, our nation would be a very different place today and a much better place. But I digress. This whole speech has turned into a digression, actually. Anyway, the... And let me tell you this. There's no stronger advocate for free market capitalism than myself. I believe that the free market economy is the most efficient and democratic way to distribute the goods of the land. But in a true free market economy, you can't make yourself rich without making your neighbors rich and without enriching your community. But what polluters do is they make themselves rich by making everybody else poor. They raise standards of living for themselves by lowering quality of life for everybody else. And they do that by escaping the discipline of the free market. You show me a polluter, I'll show you a subsidy. I'll show you a fat cat who's using political clout to escape the discipline of the free market. In every case of pollution, you look at all the Western resource issues that have driven the environmental movement in this country over the past, you know, 100 years. Water and grazing and mining and lumber, they're all about subsidies. If you're a farmer in the state of Idaho, you can get unlimited amounts of federal water for 11 cents an acre foot. This is our water. We bought those rivers, you know, with the Louisiana Purchase money. We built the dams, the irrigation systems, and the canals. You and I, the federal taxpayer. If we left that water in the river and sold it to the city of Los Angeles for drinking water or put it over the dam for hydropower, we would get $800 an acre foot. That's the true free market value of that commodity. So we're giving these farmers a $799 subsidy on every acre foot he uses. Because he gets the resource for free, he uses it wastefully. He grows rice in the desert. He puts Louisiana rice farmers out of business, and he sucked every river in Idaho dry. And these are not, you know, small farmers like you think of old McDonald's farm. These are giant corporations like Cargill and Monsanto and Smithfield. They've sucked every river in Idaho dry, and there hasn't been a salmon season in Idaho in 15 years. If you're a rancher in Idaho, and you want to graze your cow on my property, you're going to give me $18 a month. What happens if you have the political clout to get onto the federal land? How much do you think we charge them for the same quality land? $1.61 a month. So we're giving these ranchers a $16.39 subsidy on every animal they have every month. Because they get the resource for free, they use it wastefully. They overgraze the land. They've turned 1 million acres of our land into desert. They put the Oklahoma cattlemen out of business because they don't have federal land in Oklahoma. And, you know, these aren't the poor rural cowboy, the icon of American culture that we all want to preserve. 75% of the grazing leases in Idaho are owned by a tiny handful of families, the Simplots, the Hewletts, the Packards, and David Russell of Santa Barbara, who alone controls 1 million acres. These are the richest people in America. These are the same people who financed this revolution on Capitol Hill, beginning with the Gingrich Congress and now, you know, with the White House, and they've got their indentured servants in the United States Capitol demanding that we have, so, you know, that we have capitalism for the poor, and at the same time they are, you know, clinging to the system of socialism for the rich in these Western states where these welfare cowboys get $35 billion a year in our federal subsidies. And then they destroy our environment as part of the bargain. And I have to tell you, because I deal with these people all the time, that they're a bunch of crybabies, and you can hear them whining when you hear the, you know, pull the federal nipple out of their mouths. If you want to cut old growth timber in this country, you've got to come to us, the federal taxpayer. We own it all now. It was all the federal old growth on private land was cut during the 80s. In the Tongass National Forest, there are trees that were growing when Christ was walking the earth. Some of these 500-year-old Sitka spruce and cedars have a value on the stump of $20,000 apiece. What do we sell them for? $1.89 apiece. And half the Tongass was cut by Alaska Pulp and Paper, which is 100% Japanese-owned, and they didn't even mill them in this country. They sent them with the bark still on them over to Osaka Bay, where I saw them last summer stacked 3 stories high and buried under the waterline because it was just a giveaway of wealth. And to add insult to injury, you and I, the federal taxpayer, spend $250 million a year building logging roads so that these, you know, cut-and-run timber companies can get up to the last inaccessible parts of our national forest and cut down the last of our children's trees. The mining industry, is the worst of all. But it's all pollution is a subsidy. When general, the more conventional pollution that we have in this part of the country is the same thing. When General Electric dumped its PCBs into the Hudson, it was avoiding one of the costs of bringing its product to market, which was the cost of properly disposing of a dangerous process chemical. When it avoided the cost, it was able to outcompete its competitors, and it was able to enrich its board and directors. and shareholders, but the cost didn't go away. They went into the fish. They put the fishermen out of work. They dried up the barge traffic. They took the land off the tax rolls. All of those impacts impose costs on the rest of us that should, in a true free market economy, be reflected in the price of General Electric's product when it makes it to the marketplace. But what GE did, which is what every polluter does, is to use political clout to escape the discipline of the free market and force the public to pay its costs of production. And what all of the environmental laws are meant to do, the federal laws, is to reestablish the free market in this country. Jim Hightower said, the free market is a wonderful thing. We should try it sometime. And in fact, we don't have a free market in agriculture in this country. Any farmer will tell you that. We don't have a free market in energy in this country. It's all subsidies. $65 billion a year of direct subsidies to the oil industry. Of course they're going to dominate the marketplace. Capitalists don't want markets. Corporate capitalists do not want free markets. And that's the thing. Is I grew up in a milieu where I was taught that communism leads to dictatorship and capitalism leads to democracy. But it's not true. Capitalism, free market capitalism, definitely democratizes a country and a people. But corporate laissez-faire capitalism has exactly the opposite effect. It robs us of our democracy because a corporate capitalist does not want a free market. He wants profits. And the best way to get profits is by shutting down your competition, and the way to do that is by getting a hold of government, by figuring out a way to control the government process that gives you an advantage in the marketplace. And that's why what's happening on Capitol Hill today and what's happening with our campaign finance system is, and all over the world this is happening with globalization, is so frightening, because we're seeing an absolute corporate takeover of our government. And, Abraham Lincoln and, all of our great political leaders, Eisenhower in his most famous speech where he talked about the military-industrial complex and warned our country about falling under the sway of these large corporations, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, who said, domination of a country by large corporations and wealthy businessmen is what is the definition of fascism. If Abraham Lincoln said at the height of the Civil War in 1863, he said, I have the South in front of me and I have the corporations behind me. And for my country, I fear the corporations more. And all of us should. And if you saw, a farmer sent me the other day a statement by Mussolini, a farmer from the Midwest, and I always get these great things from the farmers. And he sent me this statement by Mussolini that said fascism should not be called fascism. It should be called corporatism, because it's a way of making allowing corporations to run our government. If you look at the American Heritage Dictionary, the definition of fascism is control of government by corporations by right-wing corporations. And what we're seeing today in our country is, is really a complacent drift into something that I think is really depriving us, that really genuinely threatens our democracy and our country. And I want to talk just for a second. When the free market is violated, when people cheat the free market, the people who suffer the worst are the poorest members of our community. If you look at any environmental issue, whether it's access to public lands, whether it's who's having the lead paint, who's breathing the clean air, the poor shoulder the disproportionate burden in every case of environmental injury. 4 out of every 5 toxic waste dumps in America is in a black neighborhood. The largest toxic waste dump in America is Emile, Alabama, which is 85% black. The largest concentration of toxic waste dumps in America is the south side of Chicago. The most contaminated zip code in California is East L.A. Navajo youth have 17 times the rate of sexual organ cancer as other Americans because of the thousands of tons of toxic uranium tailings that have been dumped onto their reservation lands. There's 250,000 Hispanic farm workers who are poisoned by pesticides every year, and God knows what's happening with their children, because they bring that home and nobody's taking those kind of, measurements. But it's not just the poor who get hurt. It's all of us, because we own these resources. We own the waterways. That's what the law says. And the Constitution of the state of New York says the people of the state of New York own the waterways and the fisheries of the state. They're not owned by the governor, they're not owned by the legislature, and they're not owned by DEC. And they're certainly not owned by the General Electric Company. They're owned by the people. The law is that everybody has a right to use them, Nobody has a right to use them in a way that will diminish or injure their use and enjoyment by others. And this is ancient law. It goes back to Roman times. The Code of Justinian said that, and I'll tell you this, and this is another digression which I apologize for, but the public trust doctrine, which was first described constitutionally in the Code of Justinian, says that that those things that are not accepted, that are not susceptible to private ownership, the things that are part of the commons, the air that we breathe, the flowing waters, the fisheries, all of these were enumerated in the Code of Justinian, the dune lands and wetlands, that those belong to the people. In ancient, everybody can use them, nobody can use them in a way that injures their use and enjoyment by others. In ancient Rome, the emperor himself could not stop a citizen of Rome, whether they're rich or poor, humble or noble, young or old, from crossing the dune lands, throwing a net into the water and taking out the fish. He couldn't sell a monopoly to the fish because all of the people owned them. They were not something that was owned by the state. They were owned by the people. Now, when Roman law broke down during the Dark Ages, many of the feudal kings and lords of Europe began, local, you know, dukes and lords, began reasserting control of the public trust assets, began, you know, stealing the commons from the people. For example, in England, King John said that the wandering animals no longer belong to the people, they belong to the nobility. Only the nobility, for example, could hunt deer. And that's what got him in trouble with Robin Hood. He also sold monopolies to the fisheries of England, and he erected barriers on the navigable waters, including the Thames, navigational tolls. And the people were so outraged that they rose up and they confronted him at the Battle of Runnymede, and they forced him to sign the Magna Carta, which was the beginning of constitutional government on our planet. And the Magna Carta was the birthplace, the Bethlehem of our Bill of Rights for the United States Constitution, but it also has two additional chapters, one that guarantees free access to the fisheries of England and another that guarantees free access to the navigable waters. And when we had the revolution in this country, those rights descended to the people of the states. And we own those things. That's what the law is today. Every state in its constitution has a guarantee that those things are owned by the people. But what's happening now is that, and these fishermen, you know, who mobilized in the Hudson back in 1966, they weren't sophisticated people. They probably didn't talk a lot. They were smart. They probably didn't talk a lot about the Magna Carta, the Code of Justinian. But they knew they owned the fish in the Hudson, and they knew what the Constitution of New York said. And they said, we own the fish, but we can't use them anymore because General Electric used them up. They liquidated them for cash, and they turned them into profit, and then they left, and they destroyed our industry, which is 350 years old, but we didn't have the political clout to protect it. There was no hearing. There was no due process. They simply stole our livelihood, our property, the thing that we own. And that is an act of theft, and these people have to be treated as thieves. And they began hauling them off to court and, lo and behold, winning their cases. And they not only succeeded in restoring the Hudson, but they also generated this extraordinary wealth of environmental case law that is now used by communities all across North America to protect their own local resources. I want to say one last point, which is this, and is a direct answer to what that young student asked me, and what when I talked to her, she said, you know, don't we protect the nature for its own sake? We don't protect nature for its own sake. We protect it because we recognize that nature enriches us. It enriches us economically, yes. It's the basis of our economy, and we ignore that at our peril. The economy is a wholly owned subsidiary, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. But it also enriches us aesthetically and recreationally and culturally and historically and spiritually. And human beings have other appetites besides money. And if we don't feed them, we're not going to grow up. We're not going to become the kind of beings that our Creator created us to become. When we destroy nature, we diminish ourselves. We impoverish our children. We're not fighting to protect those ancient forests in the Pacific Northwest, as Rush Limbaugh loves to say, for the sake of a spotted owl. We're preserving those forests because we believe the trees have more value to humanity standing than they would have if we cut them down. And I'm not fighting for the Hudson River for the sake of the shad or the sturgeon or the striped bass, but because I believe my life will be richer, my children and my community will be richer if we live in a world where there are shad and sturgeon and stripers in the Hudson, and where my children can stand on the banks and see the fishermen in their tiny open boats doing what they've been doing for generations and touch them when they come to shore to repair their nets or to wait out the tides. And in doing that, connect themselves to 350 years of New York State history and understand that they're part of something larger than themselves. They're part of a continuum. They're part of a community. I don't want my children to grow up in a world where there are no commercial fishermen left on the Hudson, where it's all, you know, Unilever and Gorton Seafood in 400-ton trawlers 100 miles off the coast, strip mining the oceans with no interface with humanity or with our communities. I don't want, you know, or where there are no family farmers left in this country, where it's all Cargill and Smithfield, you know, raising animals in factories, producing pork in factories and eggs, and where we've lost touch with the seasons and the tides and the things that connect us to the 10,000 generations of human beings that were here before there were laptops, and that, you know, and that connect us ultimately to God. And I don't believe that nature is God or that we ought to be worshiping it as God. But I do believe that it's the way that God communicates to us most forcefully. And, you know, God talks to human beings through many vectors, through each other, through organized religion, through the great books of those religions, through wise people, through art and literature and music and poetry and dance, but nowhere with such clarity and detail and texture and grace and joy as through creation. And, you know, we don't know Michelangelo by reading his biography. We know him by looking at the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And, you know, from the beginning of time, our great theological leaders and religious leaders have used parables and allegories and fables taken from nature to teach us the difference between right and wrong and to teach us what the face of God looks like, whether it's, you know, the ancient pagan philosopher Aesop to the modern Christian theologian C.S. Lewis with his Narnia tales and everybody in between, Confucius and Buddha, the Upanishads, Hinduism, the Quran, where all of the prophets come out of the desert and all of them are shepherds, and that daily contact with wilderness and gives them a special contact, gives them a special access to the wisdom of the Almighty. The Old Testament is the same thing. All of the prophets are shepherds. All of them came out of the desert. And the seminal stories are the Garden of Eden, which is a mandate for stewardship, and Noah's Ark, which is a mandate for biodiversity. God didn't say to Noah, just bring two of every creature that can demonstrate a current economic value. He said, bring them all on board because they're, you know, because I made them and they're good. And the New Testament, where, you know, Christ is born in a manger surrounded by animals, and that's not an accident, and where he discovers his divinity for the first time while he's spending 40 days in the wilderness. You know, that's why we come to the Omega, because it gives us that contact with spirituality. And if you look at, you know, every major religious tradition, the central revelation always occurs in the wilderness. You know, Buddha had to sit under the tree. Muhammad had to go up to the wilderness of Mount Hera and wrestle the angel on a camping trip in order to get the Ramadan squeezed out of them in the wrestling match, the first lines, the first stanzas of the Quran. Moses had to go to the wilderness of Mount Sinai to get the commandments. The Jews had to spend 40 years in the wilderness to purify themselves from the, you know, the slavery of Egypt. Christ had to go to the wilderness to discover his divinity, and his mentor was a man of the wilderness, John the Baptist, who lived in a cave and dressed in the skins of wild beasts and, you know, ate the honey of wild bees. And all of Christ's parables are taken from nature. I am the vine, you are the branches, the mustard seed, the little swallows, the lilies of the field, the scattering of the seeds on the fallow ground. He calls himself a fisherman, a farmer, a vineyard keeper. The reason he did that was because that's how he stayed in touch with the people. He was saying things that were revolutionary, that contradicted everything they'd heard from the literate, sophisticated people of their time. And they would have dismissed him as a quack, but they were able to confirm the wisdom of his proverbs through their own observations of the fishes and the birds. And they were able to say, he's not telling us something new. He's simply illuminating or deciphering messages that were written into creation at the beginning of time by the Creator, and we've never been able to discern them until now. Now, when I go into a courtroom or when I sit across a negotiating table from a polluter, it's often difficult to work a lot of this stuff into the conversation because these aren't currencies that we've integrated into our corporate culture and you know, judicial culture, but nevertheless, they're critical. I won't say to our survival, because we're an ingenious race, and we could probably devise a way to survive, you know, on a rock. But to the quality of our survival, the quality of our communities, our sense of responsibility to the next generation, the quality of our lives, and our ability, our capacity to sense the divine, They're absolutely critical, and that's why we preserve these things. And you know, and that's why when we destroy them, it's a moral issue for all of us. That you know, I don't believe that it's prudent for us to destroy you know, these large chunks of nature. And I doubt if we have the right to do it to our children. And that's really all that environmental advocacy is. It's about recognizing that there's a responsibility to the next generation and to the other members of our community who shoulder the disproportionate burden of environmental injury because they don't always participate in the political process. Of course, our children can't ever participate because they're not born yet.